Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. As I'm sure most listeners will know, Maurice Lindsay, the former chief executive of both Wigan Rugby League Club and the Rugby Football League, died last week aged 81. He created the all-conquering Wigan team of the 1980s and 1990s, masterminded the introduction of Super League in 1995 and was behind many innovations in British Rugby League, not least the introduction of the World Club Challenge in 1987, which Wigan dominated in its first decade. Maurice was born in Horwich, a town on the soccer side of the invisible border between Wigan and Bolton, which separates rugby league land from soccer country. He grew up loving both codes of football, with his teenage sporting idols being Bolton Wanderers' iconic centre-forward Nat Lofthouse and Wigan's immortal Billy Boston. He made his money in plant hire and as an on-course bookmaker, and in 1980 he became a director of Wigan Rugby League Club. The club was then in the deepest slump it had seen since the very early 1900s. They hadn't won the Championship for 20 years or the Challenge Cup for 15. Most ignominiously of all, in 1980 they were relegated to the second division. For a club that viewed itself as the flagship of rugby league, this was beyond unacceptable and a grievous blow to the town itself, which was reeling from the closure of its coal mines and cotton mills, the two foundation stones upon which Wigan was built. Maurice decided that something had to be done, and he teamed up with Jack Robinson, Tom Rathbone and former player Jack Hilton to take over the club in November 1982. As would become typical, Maurice achieved this through a mixture of guile and unstoppable determination, a personal cocktail which would become familiar to friend and foe alike over the next few decades. He visited dozens of Wigan shareholders, the vast majority of whom had no interest in the internal politics of the club, and persuaded them to give their proxy votes to him at a special shareholders meeting. That meeting voted by 413 votes to 15 to reduce the board of directors from 10 members to just 4, and the four directors elected were Robinson, Rathbone, Hilton and Lindsay. By this time, Wigan were back in the First Division, and the new board sought to secure the future by buying a new team. There was nothing new in this. Hull had pulled themselves up from the depths of Division 2 in the late 70s by buying half its team from West Yorkshire clubs. And by 1983, the strategy paid dividends when Wigan finished third in the First Division and won the John Player Trophy, their first silverware in almost a decade. The following year, they reached the Challenge Cup final but lost to Widnes, the dominant Challenge Cup team of that previous decade. They returned the following year, reinforced by numerous signings, most notably the brilliant Australians Brett Kenny and John Ferguson, and defeated Hull 28-24 in a spectacular cup final. Seeing what was possible, Maurice now pressed the pedal to the metal. A few months later, he made Wigan's greatest signing since Billy Boston when he signed Ellery Hanley in a £150,000 deal. In February 1987, he persuaded New Zealand national team coach Graham Lowe to take over at Wigan. By now, the club was a full-time professional team, the only one in the league, and this laid the basis for their incredible run of 8 consecutive League and Cup doubles from 1988. The little lad from Horwich had built one of the greatest rugby league teams of all time. Under Maurice, Wigan became a household name beyond rugby league, and he in turn became the only administrator in the history of the game to become a minor celebrity in the wider world of sport. Slightly camp, slightly roguish, Maurice was a picaresque character who could have easily been portrayed by the great comic actor Roy Barraclough. He was a master of publicity, easily able to switch between charming and intimidating journalists. And, as readers of Steve Mascord's recent book on the Super League War, Two Tribes, will know, Maurice's somewhat conditional relationship to the truth allowed him to emerge blameless from many situations which were not to his liking. Superficially, he fitted the 80s Thatcherite stereotype of a self-made entrepreneur defying stuffy bureaucracy. But in fact, he was mainly the sharpest of a long line of nouveau riche small businessmen who had controlled the clubs and the RFL since 1895. Workington Town's Tom Mitchell in the 1950s, Wakefield's Stuart Hadfield in the 1960s and Salford's Brian Snape in the 1970s were all archetypes of the strong-willed local businessman rebelling against the flat-cap complacency of the governing body. Much of Maurice's success at Wigan was due to his ability to ride the wave of rugby league's increase in popularity, which had begun in the late 1970s. Under the leadership of David Oxley, the game's downward trajectory was reversed, and by the late 1970s, rugby league was at its healthiest since the early 1960s. The domination of the game by Hull and Hull KR in the late 1970s and early 1980s also helped raise the profile of the sport. Like Wigan, they had both been aggressively ambitious, breaking the transfer fee record regularly and bringing in players from New Zealand, and later, following the lifting of the international transfer ban in 1983, from Australia. Combined with the glamour of the all-conquering 1982 Kangaroo team, imports from Down Under gave the British game a cosmopolitan flavour for the first time in decades. Morris learnt well from the success of the Hull clubs, as well as from Dougie Lawton's great witness team of the mid-1980s, but he also had the vision and the drive to take things higher and further. But his vision was costly, very costly. His dealings on the transfer market introduced massive inflation into the sport. In early 1992, Wigan paid Widnes an eye-watering £440,000 for Martin Afaya, the highest of numerous six-figure deals that Morris made. With typical chutzpah, he told the press in 1994, however, that player movements caused panic and unrest in the British game because other clubs were offering ridiculous money for average players. It was the road to ruin. In 1993, Wigan announced a loss of £300,000 on a turnover of just £3 million. The following year, its wage bill exceeded £2 million. Alongside this huge wage bill, the club also fell victim to the accumulating costs of maintaining its Central Park Stadium, a problem which eventually saw them forced to ground share with Wigan Athletic at the then JJB Stadium from 1999. The club's troubles were left to others less talented than Morris to deal with, because in November 1992, he was appointed to be David Oxley's successor as only the fifth ever chief executive of the Rugby Football League. Admired, envied, and sometimes hated by many of the sport's decision makers, his record with Wigan meant that he was the only real choice for the role. Under Morris, the pace of change in the game quickened. He set up a study group to look at switching the season from winter to summer, a campaign that had been started by Sheffield's Gary Hetherington a few years earlier. In 1994, the Framing the Future document was published, advocating a 16-team Premier League, mergers of clubs, improved stadia and a salary cap. But Morris struggled outside of the club environment. Leading a sport was vastly different from running a club, and Morris's micromanagement style meant he felt that he had to control every aspect of RFL business. As one short-lived high-profile RFL employee told me at the time, Morris is the RFL. But this reform programme was blown apart by the announcement of Super League in Australia in early 1995. Morris, who had cultivated good contacts with broadcasters and Australian league officials, was central to the coming of Super League to Britain later that year. More likely than not, he was the architect of the original plan to merge clubs in Cheshire, Calderdale, Cumbria, Hull, Manchester and pretty much everywhere else. The fact that his own club was one of a mere five to retain their independence only made the proposals worse. He also upset thousands by arbitrarily refusing promotion to Second Division champions Keighley, a decision he continued to defend until his dying day. He also missed the chance to use the made-up millions to completely restructure the governance of the game, with the result that no fundamental structural changes were made at that point. The outcry was so great that Morris quickly abandoned the merger plans, but outside of Wigan, he became the focus of fans' opposition to the Super League project. His predecessor as RFL chairman, David Oxley, used to tell a story about driving through Bradford with Morris to a speaking engagement when they got lost. Morris stopped the car and David wound down the passenger window to ask an old lady for directions. As she came closer, she looked into the car, saw Morris in the driver's seat and exclaimed, You've ruined our game, you bloody so-and-so. Although she didn't say so-and-so. When Australian courts issued an injunction against Super League in Australia, Morris flew to Sydney to be the public face of the attempt to circumvent the ban and proposed a competition called Global League, comprising those players who had signed Super League contracts. But once the Super League dust had settled, Morris found the daily politicking and compromises involved in running the RFL too frustrating, and eventually he returned to Wigan in 1999. It was never quite the same. Wigan had to leave Central Park and the club was bought by Dave Whelan, not only a soccer man, but someone whose management style made even Morris look like a blushing wallflower. When the press was full of talk about the supposed death of Rugby League and merger with Rugby Union in the early 2000s, Morris met with union officials and wondered publicly whether a merger was inevitable. As with so many others of similar mercurial brilliance, the world had changed and he was no longer the master of his times. With the passing of Morris Lindsay, Rugby League, and the world itself, is a poorer place. At times a brilliant visionary, at others a study in naked self-interest, Morris built the greatest club side since Harold Wagstaff's Huddersfield and brought to the sport an excitement and a glamour it had rarely seen before or since. It's often said that, in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. That could well describe Maurice Lindsay's rise to prominence in rugby league. But what an eye, and what a man. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My Twitter handle is @ColinsTony, and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find the complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and some of the other football codes, together with show notes for this episode. Until next time, thanks for listening.